Hits 105 Radio. Women making waves.
You didn't go to university when you left the school, did you, Susie?
No, I didn't actually. I didn't at all. Apart from the fact I didn't know that that was an option for me. It wasn't really presented to me, but I came from a single parent family and my mom worked all the time and there was never really any discussion. It was a go to school, get your exams and then go out and work. It just wasn't presented to me.
No, I think I was kind of much the same, in as much as nobody else in my family had gone to university at the time. Yeah, it just wasn't. I did think about it, but there were no topics that I was good enough to do, I think, actually.
Yeah.
It's now just a thing that a lot of people do, isn't it? It's very different to when we were young.
It is, and I think it's turned its corner a little bit now. But just going back, I do remember one question as I was at school is, what do you want to do when you're older? And I still remember the answer now. Shall I tell you what it was?
Yeah, I can't wait.
Okay, well, it's not that exciting, but it was to be a ballet dancer. And if I couldn't be a ballet dancer, I would have to be a secretary.
So did you do ballet then?
Yeah, but very badly, very badly, very, very badly.
So was this
badly.
When you were really young and being asked that? This wasn't when you were leaving school at what, 16, 17, 18, whatever.
No, I think I'd well and truly realised that that was not an option. I was really heavy on the feet, let's put it that way. But no, I just, it was one of those things. I used to draw ballet dancers and have them up in my room. It's so far from what I've ended up doing, but it's an extraordinary thing. Is how do you know at 11 years old what you want to do? That's the key, isn't it?
Well, you don't, do
no,
you?
Exactly.
It's all fantasy, really,
yeah.
When you're much younger. And you know what? Sometimes it's fantasy when you're 18 as well, you know, and when you're even older. You know, I think people, a lot of people, they go off down one path, change their minds,
yes,
and end up doing something completely different. And sometimes things that are completely unexpected and even surprise themselves. Look at the number of people that we have spoken to who said, oh, I'd never have imagined when I left the school that I'd end up doing this, that,
absolutely,
or t'other.
Yeah. But do you look back and think, how did I do it? Do you find that sometimes? Do you think about how you got there?
Well, I do look back and think a lot of the things I did were learned on the job. And I always thought that was the best place to learn. And I see people coming out of university now into, and I'm doing something quite different now. I'm working in IT now, but I see people coming out of university and they've got a lot of learning behind them,
yeah,
and a lot of very general kind of basic knowledge. But actually, they start to learn what they're doing when they start in the workplace. It's a very different experience.
It is. And so we can come on to our first guest, which is Maya Fleming, who has done just that, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. I think quite young. She's about 19, 20. She's an apprentice and she's going to be telling us all about what it's like to be an apprentice quantity surveyor and how she's kind of learning on the job. And I think it's a brilliant idea. I think this apprenticeship, I think it's the way forward, you know. Not for everything. You couldn't start as an apprentice doctor, you know, and then, you know, make a lot of mistakes until you got there. I mean, you couldn't do that.
Exactly.
There are certain things that will always have to be taught, you know, thoroughly.
Yeah.
But I think there's an awful lot of work where it would just benefit to watch other people, to shadow other people, to be given little bits of work and build your way up doing that. I think it's an excellent way. And you're earning at the same time.
And also there was something that I read somewhere that where a mother had said to her daughter, Mum, if I can't do this, I probably need to do a secretarial course, won't I? And I think in the book she says, absolutely not, because that's where you'll go. But if you don't have that behind you, it will force you to learn something else because you need to do it, to never have something to fall back onto.
Oh, right. That's a really interesting approach, and unlike most parents that I've ever met, to be fair. Because most people do want everyone to have a way of earning a living, you know, whether it's in bars or waitresses or whatever, you know. It's always quite good to have more than one string to your bow.
Well, that's true. But I think that So that's a different way of thinking about it now, isn't it? 20, 30 years ago, you had that thought, you have to have something to fall back on. But then again, did men have that? Did men have something to fall back on? Did they have secretarial courses offered to them?
Actually, you're making a good point there. Although I do think that a lot of men that went into the riskier careers, they would often be quite dab hands at other things. And then we're looking at someone who has a career, and this is our next guest. She has a career, but she's doing something quite extraordinary in her spare time.
Yeah.
And that's working as a coxswain for the RNLI. Amazing, incredible work.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of sacrifice to this particular lady has a full-time job as well as volunteering as a coxswain for the RNLI. And we'll be hearing all about her interesting insights to this role.
You're listening to Women Making Waves radio show and podcast, brought to you by Susie Thorpe and Linda Ness. This show is all about women doing extraordinary things.
Maya Fleming, our guest today, is an assistant quantity surveyor at Henry Riley Consultants in Cambridge. Now, having started her apprenticeship in July 2021, Maya has spoken to two UK Construction Week panels to discuss women in construction and how to revolutionise the industry. Maya is incredibly keen on sharing her experience as an apprentice and makes lots and lots of visits to schools and colleges to enlighten students on the opportunities available to them and empower them to start their career. Now, Maya says that establishing a strong mentoring web means people at all levels can feel supported and flourish. Welcome, Maya.
Thank you, Susie.
Maya, you finished at Hills Road Sixth Form in 2021, as Susie said, and you went straight into your apprenticeship. Now, I'm kind of guessing that a lot of your friends probably went to university. So I'm interested in why you chose to do an apprenticeship. How did you reach that decision?
Thank you, Linda. So I was in quite a large friendship group sort of going through school, as you always are when you're a teenager. And I was the only one that chose not to go on to university. And it was a pretty daunting decision, to be honest, at the start, especially just apprenticeships weren't particularly well known or sort of advertised very positively in Cambridge at the time. So I was very scared to admit that to my parents that I wasn't going to go into university. But the reason that I made my decision was really due to the experience that I had during COVID and the type of education that I was receiving. So at Hills Road, obviously it's a really large sixth form college, and they chose to group us into large lecture halls to complete our lessons, and they changed our timetable to 2-hour lessons. And it really did reflect the type of studies that we were going to get at university, which was fantastic for the students of the at Hills Road that knew that that was the path that they wanted to take. But for me, I just realized that it wasn't for me at all. Like, I just don't learn in sort of very like lecture hall, teacher at the front, all students listening, writing notes, like very structured format. That's just not the best way for me to learn. I learn by making mistakes, being given opportunities to try things out, seeing it firsthand. And I like to know why. Like, and I know it sounds silly, but like if someone tells me this is what happens or this is how it works, I want to know why. And I just found that like when I was one student in a room full of 100 people or a Teams call of 100 people, I just couldn't get that human interaction where like when I'm in a workplace, if someone tells me this is what you need to do, I'll be like, why? And they'll tell me and it's amazing. And I just realised that like the work environment was for me. Like I wanted that one-to-one connection. I wanted to be mentored. I wanted a line manager who was going to support me through my studies. And it wasn't a case at all that I didn't want to progress my education further, that I didn't want to get a degree. It was just the fact that I knew that the lecture setup wasn't for me. And I think I was just felt like I'd matured enough and I was ready to go into the working world at that point. Yeah, just surrounded by adults was just kind of like the thing that I was like craving.
That's quite a mature thing to think about. I mean, it's quite interesting how you recognise that at that age. I would say, what was that? Was that 18 that you recognise that?
Yeah, so at the time I was working part-time in a shop as well. So through lockdown, I was working full-time as well. So I kind of had that experience of like getting a paycheck as well. And I was someone that went through school and was so passionate about it. I loved learning. I loved all my lessons. And then through COVID, I just lost all of that passion. And I think it was just the schooling setup, which is absolutely no fault of their own from Hills Road. Like, they did the absolute best they could, and it worked for so many students. Mm. It just didn't work for me, and I knew I needed to look for something different.
What was the tipping point? Where did you go? What was the moment where you thought, I'm not going to go to university, and what opportunities were there around for you?
So Hills Road has got an amazing careers department, and I sort of used my initiative and I went and spoke to them and I asked them to explain to me what is the process after leaving sixth form if you're not going to university, because I don't think as a student and as a pupil you ever really think about that, because you get into primary school and it's just automatically secondary school, and you get to secondary school and it's automatically sixth form, and all of a sudden you have a world of opportunities out there for you, and you assume that there is only one, that's university. But I knew that wasn't right for me, so I asked them to explain it, and they told me that obviously I can go find a job that I don't need a degree for, and I can work my way up if that's something that I'm looking for, or I can find an apprenticeship. And the apprenticeship that I do is a level 6 degree apprenticeship, so it means that 20% of my working hours is dedicated for independent study. But I didn't know that that was an option. So the first thing I was looking for was an accountancy apprenticeship, because one of my friends from netball had recently started that 2 years before me, and she'd spoken to me about it. And I knew that my brain was quite like mathematical. It wasn't particularly creative. And I thought that that was something that I would be really interested in. So it was through a friend really that got me looking at other opportunities as well as the careers department. But then I realised that I didn't really want to be sat in an office all day. So I spoke to careers and asked, what jobs are there that are out there that mix it up, and I can be sat in an office one day and out chatting to people and making connections another day? And then that's sort of how I progressed. And it was like accountancy, then it was different finance degrees, and then it was looking at those sorts of skills in different industries, and I finally landed on a quantity surveyor in construction. It just progressed from there, really. I was watching YouTube videos every evening in like Days of a Life of a Quantity Surveyor, and like just a proper like teenage approach to learning choosing what their career is going to be. Go straight to social media.
Interesting.
But yeah, and then I just realized that it was like, it just looked like everything I wanted. So yeah, that's how I landed on it. Started applying for a few different job roles that were being advertised, and then found Henry Riley, who, yeah, just I went in there and I just knew instantly. I honestly walked out and I went for dinner with my friends and I said, that's it, that's my job, that's the one I want. And I was
that's brilliant.
I mean, they hadn't offered it to me yet, but I still knew it was mine. I was so adamant that I wanted to take it.
I think it's a really good approach, actually. In fact, I took my daughter to an apprenticeship evening when she was leaving sixth form, because I thought it was a really good way of doing it. You know, what you described earlier on as you like doing things and learning on the job effectively, I think it's better, in fact. What kind of qualifications did you need, by the way?
So for me to get my job at this, when I entered, I needed 96 UCAS points, which is the equivalent of 3 C's at A-level. And there is other ways to get it through BTECs and diplomas, but it boils down to 96 UCAS points. And that is through any subject at all. So you could be studying. I think this is a big misconception that when you are choosing your A-level, sometimes you choose the ones that think are going to set you up for your career in the best way possible. But you're too young to really know that. I mean, I was quite fortunate that I did do maths, I did biology, and then I did religious studies and philosophy because that's what I was enjoying at the time. But honestly, I could have studied anything and still achieved the grades that I needed to land my job, which is really good. And then when I finish my apprenticeship, I'll have a Bachelor's of Science degree in quantity surveying, and then I will go on to do my chartership, which is essentially further progress than someone that would leave university with a degree.
That's so enlightening to hear. It really is. I love the way you literally just jump ship and don't, you know what, I'm not going to do that. You mentioned earlier, Maya, that you said I need to be brave enough to tell my parents I wasn't going to do university. I mean, how was that? I mean, I get the impression that your parents were very laid back, but you seem to want to be able to explain to them that the university was not for you.
Yeah, so my mum went to university and my dad didn't. So their opinion on why I should go was slightly different. My mum wanted me to go because she felt like I was a high achiever. She felt like I was academically capable to go. If I'm being completely honest, she just thought it was the done thing. It had never crossed her mind that I would do something different. And she'll be happy for me to say this. Like, she knows that that's how she felt. And the difficult thing with applying for an apprenticeship is the fact that the time scales while going through sixth form is completely different to someone that is applying for university. So when you're applying for university, you start writing your personal statements and go through the UCAS process in September, and by Christmas you've sort of written your personal statement, they're in with your tutors, they're reviewing them, and you're applying for universities, you're going to open days right from the start of year 13. Whereas when I was applying for my apprenticeship, there's National Apprenticeship Week, and don't quote me on this, but I think it's at the end of February towards the start of March. So it's much later on in the academic year. I think it was just very unnerving for mum to see all my friends getting university offers, knowing what their next plan was, knowing like where they were going, and like their parents will start preparing for it. And I hadn't even applied for a job yet because I knew that I wasn't going to university. Jobs weren't available for me to start putting applications in. So I just had to sit tight and be really, really self-assured that this was the right thing and just basically wait it out. Honestly, she'll hold her hands up now. She says she eats her words. It was like she's so proud of me. She thinks that I definitely made the right decision. Mm. But yeah, there was definitely some tough conversations that were had at the time just because she thought I was doing nothing. And it's not the, and I guess it was the case that I wasn't doing anything, but it is a waiting game when you're applying for an apprenticeship.
I can imagine that must have felt a little bit nerve-wracking, actually. And what did your friends think about your career choice? What were they saying to you? Did they think you were mad, or did they think it was a great idea?
I think they knew that they weren't going to change my mind, which, to be completely honest, like, I think, yeah. One of my best friends is, like, just as self-assured as me. She's gone to Loughborough to study sports science, and it was, like, in her blood to do that. And I think the passion that she saw in herself for Loughborough is the same passion that she saw in me to go into work and start my degree. So as much as she may have thought it was absolutely ludicrous and like just completely out there and probably just one of my many crazy ideas that I had as a 17-year-old, I think she just knew that deep down it was the right thing for me.
Mm. It's funny, listening to both Linda and you talk about it, because Linda's obviously the mother on this side and you're the daughter from another perspective. So it is very interesting. I'm sure, Linda, when your daughter was taking you around university, did she hint maybe that she was wanting to do an apprenticeship? And I wonder what you would have said to that.
Interestingly, when we went to the apprenticeship evening, she appreciated that it would be a good way to go, but there was nothing in the offing that appealed to her at the time. And actually, Maya, interestingly, there were people there from accountancy firms, in fact, and there was a girl from an accountancy firm that spoke so well. I thought she was great. And what she said was, all my friends are at uni, and when they come in after studying accountancy, for example, I'm going to be years ahead of them because I have learned on the job and I'm doing the qualification as well. But at the end of the day, I'll have the experience. And she actually expected to be more senior than they would be at the end of their university. And she was earning. And she was just going to say, this is a win-win situation. But it just so happened that my daughter didn't want to do any of the careers that were being offered as apprenticeships. So she did go to university.
You said that you obviously were working very hard and you were being very proactive. You knew you didn't want to go to university, so you decided that you needed to find it. I'm going to look on social media. I'm going to look on YouTube. I'm going to find out what it's like. I mean, the information out there is incredible. Did you find that really helped you?
Yes, massively, because it's probably not one of my best qualities, but I think sometimes I'm someone that needs to hear it once and then go away and mull it over and really think about it and like digest it. For example, like when I first heard the careers person say, what about a career in construction? I was probably like, construction, no. But then I sort of like went away and I had my own personal time and I could do a bit of research and I could essentially find the information on apps that I was already using every single day. I'd lie in bed at night and have half an hour on sort of Instagram and TikTok. And I already had that in my daily schedule. So I could use that time to research it. And when I was by myself and sort of late at night, I was a bit more sort of receptive to ideas and I could take it on board and really like mull it over. So I think having the information available to young people on platforms that they already use and they're already familiar with, and to be honest, they trust, rightly or wrongly so. So I think it's such a valuable tool for education purposes, as well as sort of sharing the like the latest trends and amazing new shopping hauls that they've also found. But yeah, like I think it's just really important that we're targeting the audience at the right level.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. You mentioned that when construction was brought up by the careers advisor, you kind of went, ah, construction? Which I think would be what a lot of females would think. Are there many women in the office, in quantity surveying generally?
So as females in the industry, especially from my office, we have a really, really good gender split. However, the majority of them are like earlier on in their career progression and like they are younger, sort of the younger demographic in the office, which I think I really try and take that as a massive positive, as it shows the progress we've made over the last 5 to 10 years of bringing more women into the industry. Because sort of 20, 30 years ago, well, from what I can see, there was barely any people that joined construction 20, 30 years ago and are still working in it right now in the Cambridge office at Henry Riley. But in the last 5 to 10 years, we have so many women that are like achieving amazing things in Cambridge. And that just shows that we are starting to sort of break down stigmas and we are publicising it and we are making it more attractive to the females.
That's really good to hear, actually.
So let's get on to your job then, your job as a trainee apprentice and now obviously assistant quantity surveyor. When do you finish your apprentice, Maya?
So I have 2 more years of university. So I've just started my 3rd year. And then the goal is to sit your chartership within 6 months following that. So yeah, so about 2.5 years.
So let's just do a day in the life, a short day in the life for you. I mean, how did you get into the idea of talking to people and younger people on Construction Week panels and you go to colleges and schools? How did that come about in your job?
So it was a little bit gifted to me, if I'm completely honest. I think you always have to hold your hands up when something fell in your lap. So Henry Riley have always had a really good relationship with Hills Road Sixth Form College. So that relationship was already established. And what they try and do is whenever we get new apprentices in that they feel are suited for the role, they like to pass the baton over to them, which means that the students that are currently studying are seeing younger people representing apprenticeships, because I think it can sometimes be a little bit disengaging for a director who has been working in the industry for 30 years to stand in front of 100 students and say, oh, this is what we offer, because what he does is very different to what they would be doing. So they always try and pass the baton over. So I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity that when I started Henry Riley, they wanted me to take over that role and build that relationship with Hills Road. And I think since then, my passion just really grew. So I took on that opportunity. And since then, I've been in contact with more schools and done more talks and more careers fairs. I've done a presentation to all the teachers at Hills Road, because I think the education around apprenticeships starts there and they really need to know what apprenticeships offer and how they are an like excellent route. And then I think when my managers were seeing that I was quite confident and comfortable speaking in front of people, it's just word of mouth, then the more opportunities sort of presented themselves to me. I think as an industry, we are really passionate about getting younger voices out there and heard. So the Offsite Alliance is who I spoke for at the UK Construction Week panel, and it's something that they're really passionate about, because in their words, we are sort of the future of the construction industry. So yeah, it was just word of mouth, and then did 1 year and then got invited back, and then it just progresses like that. I think when you take a risk, like, you do get the rewards from it, and it just like it spirals really, really quickly, basically.
I think that's great. And I think getting into schools and mentioning the root of apprenticeships is really great as well, and getting out of the mindset of teachers that it's university. I think that's really, really positive. So I'm really, really glad that there are people doing that. Now, looking to the future, how do you see your career panning out in the next few years? Because I know that one of the big things for women, I know you're only 20 and you're very, very young to think about this, but for women, the career breaks are often a fact of life. You know, if you have children or anything like that, how do you see your career panning out over the next sort of 10, 15, 20 years?
I think this is something that, like, I've spoken about previously when I've done panels and stuff. I am still battling through the belief that I can be a mother and have a successful career. And it's something that I find really challenging because I am so passionate about my career. I am so in love with my day-to-day role and my job that I honestly don't see myself, like, giving that up for a family. If I look like sort of forward 10 to 15 years, I truly just want to achieve as much in my career as possible. I would love to have more of an impact on schools. Henry Riley have established an Inspiring the Future team where we're sort of really trying to improve our outreach program and our early careers program. And I would just love to just keep seeing that through, keep seeing that progressing, and just really become like the best quantity surveyor that I can be. But it is a shame, sort of, as a female, that I don't feel like I can have both. I don't know whether subconsciously the reason I think I don't want the family is because I think I can't have both.
Do you have other women in your area, in your work in construction, and they find that they're the same? They have the same issues? Is it something that you think needs to be addressed at some stage in business?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that we stop being afraid of talking about it. Like, hybrid working has been amazing for females, especially mothers, because they're managing to sort of fit their career around childcare and school runs and everything else, which is fantastic. But even when I'm saying that now, I'm thinking to myself, well, it should be just as good for fathers because they also need to be fitting it
Absolutely.
Around school runs and childcare. But I mean, the biggest thing for me is just obviously right from the like day one of gorgeous new baby born, it's like mothers get so much more maternity leave than a father does. And I haven't looked into the intricacies of shared parental leave, so it would be wrong for me to like say this like outright, but if as a company we're offering a woman 6 months to a year off and we're offering a man 2 weeks, then right from the start we are setting up a family culture like the women is going to make more sacrifices in their career than the man. And I think that that's something that we really need to tackle when we're trying to look at female retention in careers and like in the industry, because it's demoralizing if you have a child who is like your pride and joy, and then you have to take 3 steps back from work and your partner gets to return like nothing is different, and he hasn't got to make any sacrifices, and he's still just as respected, and no one mm-hmm. questions whether he can manage both. Like, that's really challenging.
You're absolutely right. What we need to do is approach the thing as a problem for everybody, not just the women, because it's very much been seen as a women's issue in the workplace, I think. And I don't think it is a women's issue. I think it's a parent's issue. It's a man and woman's issue. It's, you know, if you're going to have children, then it's a joint thing. And I think it needs to be approached as such, and we need to approach the whole problem from a completely different angle. So I think you've got your finger on the pulse there. I think that's the way forward, really.
And can I just also, I think you were mentioning about parental leave. In France, very recently, France have actually changed there, where male and female have equal full pay for a certain amount, but they have equal amount of parental leave. And it's called parental leave. Now, you mentioned earlier about paternity and maternity, but we didn't talk about paternity as well. And parental leave is probably the phrase now that we need to get around, don't we, Maya? That it's something that we need to introduce into businesses. Parental leave.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand that as a business, It's unlikely that you are employing both mum and dad of said newborn baby, but it just really is important that if we could make that the norm, that it is parental leave, and like from the start everyone, it's shared responsibilities. And I understand that that's not going to work for every family, and absolutely no judgment to those that want one partner to continue working and the other one to be the parent that stays at home. That's absolutely fine, but I think it needs to be that it's not the expectation that it's always the woman. And I think it probably is that at the moment.
You're right. It should be a choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned earlier then that you love your job, and it's so lovely and refreshing to hear that at such a young age. To love your job is wonderful. As I said before, you're progressive. You want to change. You want to move forward. You're always researching. Obviously, you're doing an apprenticeship and you're doing well. But how do you handle your day life and your outside life, your private sphere and then your work sphere, because you coach netball teams, don't you, as well?
Yes.
How do you do it, Maya?
My life is pretty crazy. I work obviously a normal sort of 9 to 5 job, and I have 4 netball clubs that I coach in Cambridgeshire. And how do I manage it? I just really value the people that are close to me. And I think that when you find friends and like family members that just completely want the best for you, and like you make your circle a little bit smaller, and you find the ones that are going to stick by you through everything, that is how I manage, because I want to see them. I want to make time for them. I want to see them. And I mean, if I look back over the last 2.5 years that I've been working, my sort of social circle and everything has drastically got smaller. And obviously, I now have a social circle that is through work and a social circle that's through netball, which means that when I go into work, when I go to netball, it is a social event as well. But then the ones that are outside of that, I just think that when I'm with them, they lift me up. They make me feel better. They make me feel happier. It's like there's nothing else in the world that matters in those moments. So any free time I have, I want to spend with them. And it sounds crazy, but it just makes it work, because they're so important to me that I just find time.
That's great. There is something that it strikes me, just something to ask. When you're at work, do you ever have to visit building sites, and are there challenges there? Because they can be quite tricky environments, and for women to be in as well.
Yeah, so I quite regularly have to go out to sites by myself. There definitely is challenges. It's something that we speak about quite a lot, where like I will send an initial email or something, and then someone else will reply to the email chain and not copy me in, or they'll copy in sort of like a male colleague, or and I'll go out to site and they'll speak to the man that's there. Whether or not they're less qualified or not, and it is a challenge. And I think I try and stay really positive with that, because part of it will be the fact that I'm young. I know it's easy to make excuses, but I do think part of that is that maybe certain people in our industry sort of think that experience is power, and obviously if they see someone that's slightly older than me, they're probably going to direct conversations to them. But obviously part of it could be the fact that I'm a female as well. It is really hard. I try my best to kill them with kindness, as some say, and I just think that if I can make them respect me on a personal level, I believe that I can build my work relationship from that. So I always try and get myself in a conversation and just say, ask some questions that I don't need any technical experience to be able to ask, and I get to know them. And then I can sort of, once I feel like I'm more in control of that conversation, I can then direct it down the path that I need to progress my work. And I would say, there's never been any safety concerns of I'm the only woman on site and I feel uncomfortable, nothing like that. But it's just sometimes things that would be overlooked. On site, there'll be one female toilet and then obviously a block of men's. And the female toilet will be a store cupboard. And you'll walk in and you'll be tripping over all sorts of stuff.
Not expecting to use it.
It's as if they never even considered that a woman would be on site and stuff like that. And you laugh at it and you joke about it and you do brush it off. But yeah, it is the little things. 95% of the time, it's waters off a duck's back and I don't even worry about it. And then there's just one day where it just is a little bit too much, or and you'll get a couple cheeky comments and and you just think, oh, this is a bit rubbish. Like, and that, yeah, yeah, but, but yeah, support from your colleagues is the most important thing, I would say. Like, whenever I have been in a situation where they've spoken to the man, I would say 95% of the time they've gone, oh, actually, Maya's handling this, or please, can you direct this question to Maya or something? And that's really important. And it's a shame that it has to come from them. But yeah, it is their responsibility to help you regain power in those situations as well.
And I think also, Maya, it just sounds from the conversation we've just had that you are progressive and you're not reactive, and you see the situations, and it sounds like you're an incredibly mature lady.
Yeah,
and, you know, we have enjoyed talking to you, Maya. It's been absolutely lovely. And I know having these wonderful conversations with people like you is tremendous. And you represent so many people, and being able to see young people listen to you today will be wonderful. So, Maya, thank you so much.
Thank you very much
for being on Women Making Waves today. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you both.
You're listening to Women Making Waves radio show and podcast, brought to you by Susie Thorpe and Linda Ness. This show is all about women doing extraordinary things.
This year, the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, is celebrating its 200th year anniversary in 2024. And our guest today is Emily Heaton. Emily recently became the first female coxswain for RNLI Douglas Station on the Isle of Man. Welcome, Emily.
Hi there.
Hi, Emily.
So I am correct in saying, Emily, that Sir William Henry, 1st Baronet, was a British officer, author and philanthropist, and he was best known as the founder in 1824 of the Royal National Institution, and in particular, the first station was in Douglas in the Isle of Man. Is that correct?
The formation of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution was by Sir William Hillary in 1824. And at that point, and I'm sure there's many lifeboat stations around the coastline of the British Isles who will probably try and say that they are the very first. It's a hard-fought title, that. Now, there will be some that predate 1824 insofar as there was a life-saving service from their local harbour. But Sir William Hillary lived on the headland just above where Douglas Lifeboat still is to this day. And he used to watch the shipwrecks on the rocks, and he would be horrified at what was happening. So he formed a lifeboat station here in Douglas with a group of fairly hardy souls that were willing to go out and row out into the open seas, which I think is a whole different class of individual to what we do now. I mean, our boats are much safer than that. And they used to go out and save. And he put this plea out to the nation that he felt it should be a nationwide lifeboat service to provide coastline cover the entire way round the coastline of the British Isles, the Channel Islands, and actually he wanted to stretch it further and cover Europe as well. So his ambitious aim was certainly that nobody should be suffering from distress at sea or from shipwreck. Mm. And he went down to London, and, well, initially he was almost ignored, brushed under the carpet, and he went down, and eventually on the 4th of March 1824, his appeal to the nation got enough support in a pub in London, obviously, to start the institution, which at the time was the, I don't think it had the Royal in the title, but it was the National Society for the Preservation of Life from Shipwreck, or some such catchy title, which later became the Royal National Lifeboat Institution that we know today.
Why did you volunteer for the RNLI, Emily?
So my decision to volunteer, I suppose, starts quite a long way back. When I was much, much younger, when I was 6 years old-ish, came on holiday to the Isle of Man. I lived at the time in Sandhurst in Berkshire, which is probably geographically almost as far from the sea as you can be. And we used to come on holiday every summer to the Isle of Man and stay in Port Erin, which is on the south coast of, or the southwest coast of the island. And they always used to be a lifeboat day. So they'd have raft races and just a brilliant beach fun day. So we would always go along and just have a brilliant day out at the beach. And of course, our hotel looked out over the bay and we'd see the lifeboat launch, whether that be on training at the weekend or when the pages went off. So there was a bit of an interest in the lifeboat through that. And my father had a friend on the island who had a connection to Douglas Lifeboat. And when we were quite young, he arranged for us to go out one Sunday morning when they were doing some training. And we went out on the boat, which sadly health and safety means we can't take people out in the same way now, but back in the early 90s, it was permitted. And I guess my interest in the RNLI formed from there. And then I joined, they have like a kids club called Stormforce, and you get a magazine every quarter. And we joined, and we used to really look forward to getting that and seeing what the lifeboats were doing, and just continued that interest. So when I relocated to the island when I was 18, it just seemed like the perfect thing to do, to go to my local lifeboat station, which was Douglas, and say, how do I join? How do I become crew?
That's remarkable, actually, Emily. That's a great story, a great background to why you joined. And were you interested in boats at all? Had you done any sailing or anything like that?
A little bit of maybe dragon boating and things on the local lake through guards and scouts, you know, as you do. So, yeah, just really quite interesting for me to come in with no maritime background and say, how do I get involved?
Wow, that's great. I assumed that you'd have to be pretty experienced to start with, and clearly that's not the case. You can join with any level of experience at all.
You can. So it did used to be, going back probably 100 years, 150 years, when the RNLI was formed 200 years ago, that the crews were made up of the local fishermen and the people who worked within the local harbour. But now I would say probably a good 90%, if not more, of our crew do not come from maritime backgrounds, and all their training is given to them by the RNLI from scratch.
I really want to talk about the role of a volunteer in the RNLI, because it's one of the toughest volunteering roles, isn't it? The search and rescue. I mean, one of the things I've read somewhere is help wanted, no pay, odd hours, hard work, but you get a cool helmet. Is that how you would summarise being in the RNLI?
Certainly not far off, and you certainly get a fair few T-shirts along the way as well. I think my children wonder whether I actually own anything that doesn't have an RNLI flag on it.
Ask a silly question, but is it a really tough volunteering job?
It is, but obviously the more you put in, the more you get back out again, and the reward is incredible. You know, you come back from a rescue launch and you have potentially saved somebody's life. And I think to be able to come back and know that you've done a job well and done that and made a difference to somebody is reward in itself.
I can imagine that. And when you joined at first, what was it like? How did you actually get started? How did they kind of wean you into the thing?
So I can't remember exactly, but I think I probably sent an email or whatever you did and said, how do I join? And nothing has changed in 19 years, because if somebody asked me now how they joined, I would say, come down at our station. We train on a Thursday evening and a Sunday morning. Just come down to the boathouse. The door will be open. Come and have a chat with us. We'll show you around. And if you sort of like what you see and you think you're going to get on with us, come and join. And we are a very eclectic mix of people at Douglas, as every lifeboat station is. There's a place for everybody, and everybody will fit in, and everybody will get a huge amount out of it if they do come and join us. I think the big thing for me is, if you live near a lifeboat station and you're thinking about getting involved, whether that be as part of our fundraising family or actually going out to sea or any of the roles that we may have, or you're not sure if there's a role for you, make contact with your local station. And even some of our inland branches who do brilliant work fundraising for us, we are one crew. And what we're looking at, yes, we're celebrating the last 200 years, but we want to move ahead for the next 200 years. And it's really important that we get that message out there, that come and contact us and get involved, because it's a really great family to be part of.
And what is the role of the coxswain for the uninitiated among us? Is it like captain, really?
So, yeah, I think a lot of people just assume as coxswain, you'll drive the boat. All of our crew are trained to helm the boat or drive the boat. And as coxswain, actually, it's almost the art of not doing a lot whilst overseeing everybody else is doing everything, and trying not to take it on yourself. Because if you engage yourself in one specific task, you lose sight of the other tasks that need to happen. So it is making sure that that boat is safe the entire time it's at sea, and that whatever our mission is for that day is achieved, or we absolutely do our best to achieve it.
Are the decisions about how to go about the rescue down to you then in an emergency?
So depending on obviously what we're going out to, the Coast Guard will give us the tasking. And it may well be that if there is an area to be searched, they will give us an area and almost dictate to us how they want us to search it. But other times, sometimes we arrive on scene before those decisions have been made. So at that point, the coxswain will make a decision as to how best to deal with it at that time. And ultimately, you're the person in command of that vessel when you arrive somewhere. Nobody can really, from shore, tell you what you should and shouldn't be doing, because obviously the sea state will massively affect how close we can get to something and things like that. And it's to the, for the coxswain to say, actually, do you know what? We can't do that, but we could do this instead.
It must be a great feeling when you come back onto dry land and you have saved someone's life. But I'm assuming that there are also call-outs that maybe don't end so happily. How do you cope with that psychologically? Is there anything in place, you know, to help you guys if you do have any sort of traumatic days?
So the RNLI, they use a system called TRIM, which is Trauma Risk Management, which is something that was formed, I believe, by the Marines, and a lot of emergency services use it as well. And it's a peer-led system where we have trained up TRIM practitioners. It's a role I also do, because I do it through my day job as well. And basically, if a lifeboat crew attend a potentially traumatic incident, it gets flagged almost immediately by the station management to the TRIM team, and contact is made, and basically a team of TRIM practitioners will attend the station, generally not from that station specifically, because you, albeit peer-led, you want it to be somebody that you probably haven't been to sea with. It's almost a screening process where you have an hour's chat with the person. Basically, the TRIM practitioners, they're not a mental health professional. They are simply trained to identify risk factors and perhaps changes in that person's behaviour 3 or 4 days after the incident. And then we meet again with them 4 weeks later. And usually 4 weeks later, you'll see that they've processed things and almost kind of put it to the back of their mind and processed it quite well. But the person that still hasn't is the person that we then need to signpost on for professional help to make sure that what we don't do is just lose them as a volunteer and they go off and really struggle to deal with it.
Could you tell us what your day job is?
So my day job, I'm a trainee detective in the Isle of Man Constabulary. So I'm a police officer.
Okay, so my next question is, how the hell do you fit it all in?
You won't be the first person to ask me that. I always say I don't sleep a lot, but then other people will say that there's more than 24 hours in my day.
How many hours do you have to commit to a week, Emily?
So I think that's a really hard question to answer, because it absolutely depends on the role you hold. So if a new crew member wanted to join us, we train for, usually on a Thursday, we go down at about 7 o'clock to the lifeboat station and we'll train till about 9, and then some of them will go for a beer after, or a soft drink, they don't have to have beer. And then Sunday mornings, if we're not launching on a Sunday morning, about 10 o'clock, and we're there for maybe an hour and a half.
Okay.
Depends, you know, people can pop in during Sunday morning. And for the newer crew that need to learn a lot more, that may well be that we almost rig the anchor whilst in the boathouse, albeit we can't actually deploy it, but it's understanding where the ropes need to go and what needs connecting where and everything. Or we might do a bit of basic navigation practice on the charts. Obviously, the more experienced crew, we're there to share that knowledge with the junior crew or to teach them the knots they need to learn to tie. And sometimes it's just a matter of, we need to clean the boat down. We've washed it when we come back in, but actually the windows need properly cleaning, or batteries in torches need changing. There's always little things that need to be done. So that's sort of the basic commitment. And we tend to launch either the Thursday evening or the Sunday morning each week. So we go afloat once a week, but only 6 of us will go out, or 7 maybe. So we've got 25 crew at Douglas, so we won't all be afloat. But obviously if we do go out, it's usually a little bit longer. That's sort of your basic weekly commitment. If you're a mechanic or a coxswain and you hold one of those roles, you need to do some sort of duty, because we have to cover those roles. So whereas lifeboat crew don't work in shifts like retained firefighters, we're all just on pager call 24/7, 365 days of the year, but with an understanding that of the 25 of us, we're never all going to be available, because some of us might pop out of the town because we're going somewhere, or you might go to a family party and have a drink, or you might be on your own with your children, so it's a little bit hard to just appear at the lifeboat station. But invariably, we would get what we needed. But because to take the boat out, we have to have a coxswain and we have to have a mechanic, we share the duty of those roles between those of us trained. So here in Douglas, we have 4 coxswains. One of them's really good in that his day job is right near the lifeboat station and he can cover the daytimes. The other 3 of us, obviously, I can't leave my day job, so I tend to cover some of the evenings and maybe one of the 24-hour periods over the weekend. So I can't then leave the Douglas area. If you need to nip out and do something, you can usually get one of the others to cover for an hour or whatever. So it's about communicating with the others and making sure that role's covered. So I think when you take on the training to become a coxswain or a mechanic, you understand that you're then going to have to commit a little bit more time.
There aren't that many still female coxswains and volunteers for the RNLI. I read somewhere that part of the reason why women weren't able to volunteer is because they couldn't lift a body or a person or rescue somebody from the water onto the boat. I mean, is that still of a view, or is that, has that changed now?
I think it has changed. And I think now it's all about looking at ways that we can adapt what we do to make it achievable. So a lot of our boats now have an A-frame on the side with a pulley system. So if we're trying to recover something out of the water, we can do it using that pulley system rather than using our own sheer strength. We have a very small, we call it the X-boat, a very small daughter craft, which we inflate with a foot pump, and it's got two oars. But if we needed to, we could deploy that, and it would be easier to recover a body or whatever into that, because it's so much lower to the water, and then we can facilitate how we then move it onto our boat. A lot of females struggle. We have a salvage pump, which ultimately we would use if another vessel was taking on water. We can use that to pump water off it and try and keep it afloat. It's notoriously difficult to start, but again, a lot of it's technique. So it's about understanding that actually we just need to look at, rather than somebody just standing and saying, well, you just pull this cord, and well, if you can't do it, it's because you're not strong enough. Mm. Is it actually that you're not using the right technique, and can we work a way around it to make this better for everybody?
And do you find that more women nowadays are interested in joining the RNLI?
Absolutely. So when I joined 19 years ago, I walked into a room full of men, and I was the only girl on the crew for the best part of 10 years. But then about 9 years ago, one of our mechanics, his daughter joined the crew, and she's still there now, and she's a passed out mechanic. And then since then, we've had some other girls come along. I say girls, we're women, aren't we? But but now at Douglas, there's six of us, and with me as a coxswain and Lavinia as a mechanic, and the other four, one of them is, as I say, like substantive crew. She's done her sort of necessary training to be fully competent crew, and the other three are trainees but working up through that. We need six to crew the boat, and we're now in a position that we could take that boat to sea with all women on board.
Wow, that's wonderful.
That's brilliant.
And I'm not sure it's been done on an all-weather boat yet, so it's definitely a plan for this year, hopefully, to get that boat in the water with all of us, because there's not many female coxswains and there's not many female mechanics. To have two at Douglas with enough crew to then come out with us is just brilliant.
That'll be another first then for Douglas RNLI, won't it? Not only the first coxswain for Douglas Station, but an all-women crew. That will be quite amazing. May I and Linda put our first dibs for interviewing you all then as well when that happens?
Absolutely. It's funny, actually. The RNLI did their first ever Women in Search and Rescue conference a couple of weeks ago, and I'm very, very lucky. There were only 30 places on it. I applied and I got to go. And we went down to the lifeboat headquarters in Poole with, as you can imagine, there's 30 quite strong-minded and opinionated women who can stand up for themselves in the lifeboat station. Some quite new crew, some with years of experience, and some serving on small inshore boats, some on the all-weather boats. But absolutely, what an incredible room full of people. And one of the women said to me, she said, do you know what? She said, I try and spend my days surrounding myself with people who make me shine. She said, you've all made me shine this week. And I said, do you know what? That's absolutely right. And what a great way to live your life. But this guy came in and he did a presentation about human factors. And he was basically, in a very, very nice way, trying to say that every lifeboat call out we attend, we have the ability through our decision making to make the situation worse, not better, if it goes wrong. He said, there isn't a single job you can attend that you can't make worse. And I was like, oh no. But that's very true. And he was talking about risk and the decisions we make and how certain people are more inclined to take greater risks than others and things. But he ended his PowerPoint with this big sort of picture of a lifeboat sort of heeling over in a massive wave with rocks behind it. Just a caption across it that said, we're not normal. And do you know what? Absolutely, we're not. But I never understood that. Like when my friends say, I can't see why you do it. Like, it's madness. And I'll send them a video when we're out at sea and it's lumpy as anything. And they're like, you just make me feel sick looking at it. And I'm like, oh, it's amazing. This is brilliant. Like, I've got a man dangling off a winch wire of a helicopter flying right over my boat. And if anything goes wrong here, it could go horribly wrong. But it's brilliant. What a skill. And I just think it's a great thing to be part of.
Yeah.
I've had literally one of the best 12 months ever with passing out as a coxswain in December. And then obviously RNLI 200, which has been an absolutely fantastic time to be part of the institution. And we've still got loads more to come this year. But then obviously with the Queen's visit to the Isle of Man And Government House invited me because I'm first female coxswain, which is really lovely that it's given me a little host of other opportunities. And then the Women in Search and Rescue Conference. And last September, I applied. There's an organisation called the International Maritime Rescue Federation, and they basically are like an overarching body of all the RNLI equivalents around the world. And they do a European crew exchange. And they did it in September, and I went to the Netherlands for a week.
Oh, wow.
And there was crews from Sweden, Norway, Finland, France, the Netherlands, and the UK from each of their RNLI equivalents. And one from each went to each of the other countries. So I was in the Netherlands with somebody from each of those RNLI equivalents. Yeah, what a fantastic week to spend a week playing on Dutch lifeboats of all different types. We had a whole day where we were on jet skis doing the beach lifeguard stuff on the Dutch beaches, which I've never driven a jet ski in my life. So that was a massive experience. And just, yeah, all their boats are driven by water jets, whereas my lifeboat here in Douglas is driven by propellers. So it was just an absolutely fantastic week of great experiences and making friends and building that network across other institutions. So when you want to think, well, I'm trying to work something out and I'm trying to understand why we do things a certain way, but I've now got this group of other people I can go to and say, how does your organisation do it? And can we pull on that, and can we learn from each other?
Yeah.
And obviously that's the purpose of doing the exchange. I mean, as well as being that just a brilliant week, a huge amount of learning came out of it. And so I've had literally an absolutely fantastic 12 months, and hopefully there'll be more still to come because I'm not 40 yet. So I've got a long time left on the lifeboat crew.
Emily Heaton, thank you so much indeed for talking to us here on Women Making Waves. It's been really, really interesting and very enlightening, and credit to you and all your team. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all we have time for today on Women Making Waves. Our thanks to our guests, Maya Fleming and Emily Heaton. We are always on the lookout to feature women living extraordinary lives, so please do contact us if you know of someone we should be talking to.
You can contact us via social media on X and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at WomenMakingWaves. You can also find us on Cambridge105.co.uk or visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.